Chapter 14. The bright sunshine of the clear mistless morning, after the stormy night, flooded the main path of the settlement leading from the low shore of the Pantai branch of the river to the gate of Abdullah's compound. The path was deserted this morning. It stretched its dark yellow surface, hard beaten by the tramp of many bare feet, between the clusters of palm trees, whose tall trunks barred it with strong black lines at irregular intervals, while the newly risen sun threw the shadows of their leafy heads far away over the roofs of the buildings lining the river, even over the river itself as it flowed swiftly and silently past the deserted houses. For the houses were deserted too. On the narrow strip of trodden grass intervening between their open doors and the road, the morning fires smoldered untended, sending thin fluted columns of smoke into the cool air, and spreading the thinnest veil of mysterious blue haze over the sunlit solitude of the settlement. Almayer, just out of his hammock, gazed sleepily at the unwonted appearance of Samber, wondering vaguely at the absence of life. His own house was very quiet. He could not hear his wife's voice, nor the sound of Nina's footsteps in the big room, opening on the veranda, which he called his sitting room, whenever, in the company of white men, he wished to assert his claims to the commonplace decencies of civilization. Nobody ever sat there. There was nothing there to sit upon, for Mrs. Almayer in her savage moods, when excited by the reminiscences of the piratical period of her life, had torn off the curtains to make sarongs for the slave girls, and had burnt the showy furniture piecemeal to cook the family rice. But Almayer was not thinking of his furniture now. He was thinking of Dane's return, of Dane's nocturnal interview with Lakamba, of its possible influence on his long-matured plans, now nearing the period of their execution. He was also uneasy at the non-appearance of Dane, who had promised him an early visit. He fellow had plenty of time to cross the river, he mused, and there was so much to be done today. The settling of details for the early start on the morrow, the launching of the boats, the 1001 finishing touches. For the expedition must start complete, nothing should be forgotten, nothing should. The sense of the unwonted solitude grew upon him suddenly, and in the unusual silence he caught himself longing even for the usually unwelcome sound of his wife's voice to break the oppressive stillness which seemed, to his frightened fancy, to portend the advent of some new misfortune. Had it happened? He muttered half aloud, as he shuffled in his imperfectly adjusted slippers towards the balustrade of the veranda. Is everybody asleep or dead? The settlement was alive, and very much awake. It was awake ever since the early break of day, when Mamat Manjer, in a fit of unheard of energy, arose, and, taking up his hatchet, stepped over the sleeping forms of his two wives, and walked shivering to the water's edge to make sure that the new house he was building had not floated away during the night. The house was being built by the enterprising Mamat on a large raft, and he had securely moored it just inside the muddy point of land at the junction of the two branches of the Pantai so as to be out of the way of drifting logs that would no doubt strand on the point during the freshet. Mamat walked through the wet grass saying burrow, and cursing softly to himself the hard necessities of active life that drove him from his warm couch into the cold of the morning. A glance showed him that his house was still there, and he congratulated himself on his foresight in hauling it out of harm's way, for the increasing light showed him a confused rack of drift logs, half stranded on the muddy flat, interlocked into a shapeless raft by their branches, tossing to and fro and grinding together in the eddy caused by the meeting currents of the two branches of the river. Mamat walked down to the water's edge to examine the rotten moorings of his house just as the sun cleared the trees of the forest on the opposite shore. As he bent over the fastenings he glanced again carelessly at the unquiet jumble of logs and saw there something that caused him to drop his hatchet and stand up, shading his eyes with his hand from the rays of the rising sun. It was something red, and the logs rolled over it, at times closing round it, sometimes hiding it. It looked to him at first like a strip of red cloth. The next moment, Mom had made it out and raised a great shout.
Aya! There! Yelled Mom at.
Here's a man amongst the logs. He put the palms of his hand to his lips and shouted, enunciating distinctly, his face turned towards the settlement, colon, there's a body of a man in the river. Come and see. A dead stranger. The women of the nearest house were already outside kindling the fires and husking the morning rice. They took up the cry shrilly, and it traveled so from house to house, dying away in the distance. The men rushed out excited but silent, and ran towards the muddy point, where the unconscious logs tossed and ground, and bumped and rolled over the dead stranger with the stupid persistency of inanimate things. The women followed, neglecting their domestic duties and disregarding the possibilities of domestic discontent, while groups of children brought up the rear, warbling joyously, in the delight of unexpected excitement. Almayer called aloud for his wife and daughter, but receiving no response, stood listening intently. The murmur of the crowd reached him faintly, bringing with it the assurance of some unusual event. He glanced at the river just as he was going to leave the veranda, and checked himself at the sight of a small canoe crossing over from the Raja's landing place. The solitary occupant in whom Almayer soon recognized Babalichai effected the crossing a little below the house, and paddled up to the lingered jetty in the dead water under the bank. Babalichai clambered out slowly, and went on fastening his canoe with fastidious care, as if not in a hurry to meet Almayer, whom he saw looking at him from the veranda. This delay gave Almayer time to notice, and greatly wonder at Babalichai's official get-up. The statesman of Sambar was clad in a costume befitting his high rank. A loudly checkered sarong encircled his waist, and from its many folds peeped out the silver hilt of the kris, that saw the light only on great festivals, or during official receptions. Over the left shoulder, and across the otherwise unclad breast of the H. diplomatist, glistened a patent leather belt bearing a brass plate with the arms of Netherlands under the inscription, Sultan of Sambar. Babalachi's head was covered by a red turban, whose fringed ends falling over the left cheek and shoulder gave to his aged face a ludicrous expression of joyous recklessness. When the canoe was at last fastened to his satisfaction, he straightened himself up, shaking down the folds of his sarong, and moved with long strides towards Almayer's house, swinging regularly his long ebony staff, whose gold head ornamented with precious stones flashed in the morning sun. Almayer waved his hand to the right towards the point of land, to him invisible, but in full view from the jetty. Oh, Babalachi! Oh! He called out, what is the matter there, can you see? Babalachi stopped and gazed intently at the crowd on the river bank, and after a little while the astonished Almayer saw him leave the path, gather up his sarong in one hand, and break into a trot through the grass towards the muddy point. Almayer, now greatly interested, ran down the steps of the veranda. The murmur of men's voices and the shrill cries of women reached him quite distinctly now, and as soon as he turned the corner of his house he could see the crowd on the low promontory swaying and pushing round some object of interest. He could indistinctly hear Babalachi's voice, then the crowd opened before the aged statesman, and closed after him with an excited hum, ending in a loud shout. As Almayer approached the throng a man ran out, and rushed past him towards the settlement, unheeding his call to stop, and explain the cause of this excitement. On the very outskirts of the crowd Almayer found himself arrested by an unyielding mass of humanity, regardless of his entreaties for a passage, insensible to his gentle pushes as he tried to work his way through it towards the riverside. In the midst of his gentle and slow progress he fancied suddenly he had heard his wife's voice in the thickest of the throng. He could not mistake very well Mrs. Almayer's high-pitched tones, yet the words were too indistinct for him to understand their purport. He paused in his endeavors to make a passage for himself, intending to get some intelligence from those around him, when a long and piercing shriek rent the air, silencing the murmurs of the crowd, and the voices of his informants. For a moment Almayer remained as if turned into stone with astonishment and horror, for he was certain now that he had heard his wife wailing for the dead. He remembered Nina's unusual absence, and maddened by his apprehensions as to her safety, he pushed blindly and violently forward, the crowd falling back with cries of surprise and pain before his frantic advance. On the point of land in a little clear space lay the body of the stranger just hauled out from amongst the logs. On one side stood Babalatchi, his chin resting on the head of his staff, and his one eye gazing steadily at the shapeless mass of broken limbs, torn flesh, and blood-stained rags. As Almayer burst through the ring of horrified spectators, Mrs. Almayer threw her own head veil over the upturned face of the drowned man, and, squatting by it, with another mournful howl, sent a shiver through the now silent crowd. Mamat, dripping wet, turned to Almayer, eager to tell his tale. In the first moment of reaction from the anguish of his fear, the sunshine seemed to waver before Almayer's eyes, and he listened to words spoken around him without comprehending their meaning. When, by a strong effort of will, he regained the possession of his senses, Mamat was saying, "That is the way, Tuan." His sarong was caught in the broken branch, and he hung with his head under water. When I saw what it was, I did not want it here. I wanted it to get clear and drift away. Why should we bury a stranger in the midst of our houses for his ghost, to frighten our women and children? Have we not enough ghosts about this place? A murmur of approval interrupted him here. Mamat looked reproachfully at Babalatchi. But the Tuan Babalatchi ordered me to drag the body ashore. He went on looking round at his audience, but addressing himself only to Almayer, and I dragged him by the feet, and through the mud I have dragged him, although my heart longed to see him float down the river, to strand perchance on Bulangi's clearing. May his father's grave be defiled. There was subdued laughter at this, for the enmity of Mamat and Bulangi was a matter of common notoriety, and of undying interest to the inhabitants of Sambar. In the midst of that mirth, Mrs. Almayer wailed suddenly again. "Allah! What ails the woman?" exclaimed Mamat, angrily. "Here, I have touched this carcass which came from nobody knows where, and have most likely defiled myself before eating rice. By orders of Tuan Babalatchi I did this thing, to please the white man. Are you pleased, O Tuan Almayer? And what will be my recompense?" "Tuan Babalatchi said a recompense there will be, and from you. Now consider. I have been defiled, and if not defiled I may be under the spell. Look at his anklets. Whoever heard of a corpse appearing during the night amongst the logs with gold anklets on its legs? There is witchcraft there. However," added Mamat, after a reflective pause, "I will have the anklet, if there is permission, for I have a charm against the ghosts, and am not afraid. God is great." A fresh outburst of noisy grief from Mrs. Almayer checked the flow of Mamat's eloquence. Almayer, bewildered, looked in turn at his wife, at Mamat, at Babalatchi, and at last, arrested his fascinated gaze on the body lying on the mud with covered face in a grotesquely unnatural contortion of mangled and broken limbs, one twisted and lacerated arm, with white bones protruding in many places through the torn flesh, stretched out, the hand with outspread fingers nearly touching his foot. "Do you know who this is?" he asked of Babalatchi, in a low voice. Babalatchi, staring straight before him, hardly moved his lips, while Mrs. Almayer's persistent lamentations drowned the whisper of his murmured reply intended only for Almayer's ear. "It was fate. Look at your feet, white man. I can see a ring on those torn fingers which I know well." Saying this, Babalatchi stepped carelessly forward, putting his foot, as if accidentally, on the hand of the corpse, and pressing it into the soft mud. He swung his staff menacingly towards the crowd, which fell back a little. "Go away," he said sternly, "and send your women to their cooking fires, which they ought not to have left to run after a dead stranger.
This is men's work here. I take him now in the name of the Raja. Let no man remain here, but two Nalmayar's slaves. Now go. The crowd reluctantly began to disperse. The women went first, dragging away the children, that hung back with all their weight on the maternal hand. The men strolled slowly after them in ever-forming and changing groups that gradually dissolved as they neared the settlement, and every man regained his own house with steps quickened by the hungry anticipation of the morning rice. Only on the slight elevation, where the land sloped down towards the muddy point, a few men, either friends or enemies of Mamat, remained gazing curiously for some time longer at the small group standing around the body on the river bank. I do not understand what you mean, Babalatchi, said Elmayer. What is the ring you are talking about? Whoever he is, you have trodden the poor fellow's hand right into the mud. Uncover his face, he went on, addressing Mrs. Elmayer, who, squatting by the head of the corpse, rocked herself to and fro, shaking from time to time her disheveled gray locks, and muttering mournfully. Hi! Apostrophe apostrophe exclaimed Mamat, who had lingered close by. Ook, Tuan, the locks came together so, and here he pressed the palms of his hands together, and his head must have been between them, and now there is no face for you to look at. There are his flesh and his bones, the nose, and the lips, and maybe his eyes, but nobody could tell the one from the other. It was written the day he was born, that no man could look at him in death, and be able to say, this is my friend's face. Apostrophe, silence, Mamat, enough, said Babalatchi, and take thy eyes off his anklet, thou eater of pig's flesh. To an Elmayer, he went on, lowering his voice, have you seen Dane this morning? Elmayer opened his eyes wide and looked alarmed. Oh, he said quickly, haven't you seen him? Is he not with the Raja? I am waiting, why does he not come? Babalatchi nodded his head sadly. He is come, Tuan. He left last night, when the storm was great, and the river spoke angrily. The night was very black, but he had within him a light that showed the way to your house as smooth as a narrow backwater, and the many logs no bigger than wisps of dried grass. Therefore he went, and now he lies here. And Babalatchi nodded his head towards the body. How can you tell? Said Elmayer, excitedly, pushing his wife aside. He snatched the cover off and looked at the formless mass of flesh, hair, and drying mud, where the face of the drowned man should have been. Nobody can tell, he added, turning away with a shudder. Babalatchi was on his knees wiping the mud from the stiffened fingers of the outstretched hand. He rose to his feet and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.